Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Dave, thank you so much for joining us as we continue to dive into the Little Tech Agenda. I am particularly glad to have you here because relatively soon after we saw the release of the Little Tech Agenda essay from Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz, you were quick on the reply. You got that Tech Policy Press response there really quickly. But before we dive fully into that response and drill into the specifics of the Little Tech Agenda and your critiques, there's a saying that the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's maybe a different version of that that you may lean into. So I'm gonna give it a go. The future is not here, and in fact, it's overhyped. Is that an accurate summary of the Silicon Valley ideology that you've outlined? And tell us more about that ideology.
So I would say the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed, comes from William Gibson, one of my favorite authors. I like that line. I always put the emphasis on the second half, because the real point is that the future, as we imagine it, never gets evenly distributed, and that ill distribution is often the point. So a little background on me. I'm a political scientist by training. I mostly, for the first 10 or so years of my career, I was mostly studying political advocacy organizations and how they adapt to the digital age. In 2018, I decided to start a little side project. I went into my university library, just a few blocks from here actually, and read the entire back catalog of Wired magazine chronologically. That is,
wow.
For just people listening, they don't realize you just made the correct facial expression to that that choice that I made.
Yeah, so I mean, we have so much to get to, but I have to dive further into this. You wake up one morning, you think, I'm bored, I'll get a coffee, I'll walk into the library, oh, there's the Wired section, I'm just going to sit here and plop down and read the entire anthology. What drove you to say this is where I should go next?
It was worse than that.
Okay.
So it was an idea that I had had for quite a while.
Okay.
Because in my previous work, I had studied political micro-targeting quite a bit. And what I had noticed is every election cycle, there are a set of people who warn that micro-targeting is about to be so good that it breaks democracy. And we say that
How
every 2 years.
How far back are we talking?
I mean, that goes back to the 1990s.
Wow.
And so what I noticed was we keep making these predictions and keep not noticing that today's micro-targeting still has all the flaws. Maybe we should learn from the past predictions that didn't come true. That was an idea that I had for a while. Actually, in 2017, I decided my first child was born, and I was like, it would be really fun to get all the Wireds and start doing this.
Right.
No, like, on parental
leave. Baby. Let me just keep
I'll just
reading.
Do what she's sleeping.
Yeah, right.
That was clear evidence that I hadn't had the kid yet. Yeah, that was not going to work. And also, in 2017, I entered the university library, and they said, no, you can read these on reserves. You can't take them home. So that was dead.
Yeah.
But 2018 was the 25th anniversary of Wired. I was talking to an editor there about some other stuff and mentioned the project, and he said, would you want to write that for our 25th anniversary issue?
Wow.
So I went in on with a mission, which was, we're going to read all of this. We're going to trace the digital futures that never arrived. And then I'll write about it for the magazine, which is kind of cool. So that gave me the impetus to start this project that I've now been working on for about 7 years. I'll have a book coming out on it. It's in the October 2018 issue of Wired, but there's a book-length version that's going to come out spring or summer 2026. Tentative title is Why the Digital Future Never Arrives, but we're going to do better than that.
Okay. It's not bad.
Yeah, it's pretty good, but I think it'll be even punchier. But that was a real introduction to the stories that Silicon Valley is always telling about how the pace of technological change is constantly getting faster, so fast, in fact, that government just has to stay out of the way because they'll ruin it if they get involved. And therefore, we need to trust the innovators and the entrepreneurs and the engineers of Silicon Valley. They will build the future, and the rest of us need to kind of sit back and clap. That's a story they were telling in the 90s, they were telling in the aughts, they were telling it in the teens, and they're telling it today. And the main thing, once you have that historical perspective, the main thing that stands out is what Mark Andreessen, first in the Techno-Optimist Manifesto and then later with the Little Tech Agenda, is largely doing is saying that there was a status quo that we had that went very well for investors like me. we've been getting away from it, particularly during the Biden years. They've started to apply regulations to tech firms where they used to just sort of look the other way. He doesn't like that, and he'd like to go back to his old status quo. And then he's also dressing that up with all these promises of how this is going to work out for everyone. This will make us all wealthier and happier and wiser. But again, if you look over the course of the past 30 years, they've been saying that for a long time. And the results are pretty mixed. We never live up to their promises.
And so I'm really curious about how this idea of the future's right here, we're going to achieve it, overlaps with your study of politics in particular, because I think this is a great angle of the corollaries and the overlaps with, for instance, the lottery came to mind when you were speaking of here's a better future. Mm-hmm. We're going to get there if you just trust, if you gamble even on this solution. Mm-hmm. How have we seen that play out, for example, in earlier waves of technology? So I'm keen to hear your take on, for example, even the early internet era, mm-hmm. how we saw that manifest and moving into social media about this, the better future's here and why didn't we achieve it? Or have we achieved it in some ways? What's your take?
So there's two. I mean, of course, I could go for 5 hours on this. The
we'll
short
have you
version
back. We'll have you back.
Sounds good. Yeah. When the book comes out, please come.
There we
back.
Go.
The short version is that whole project of saying the future, not that it's here, but that it's about to arrive. Mm-hmm. And that Silicon Valley are the creators of it. That hinges on something called Moore's Law that I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of.
I hope so,
but,
yes. But go ahead, just in case your daughter listens to this in a few years.
In a few years, good, because she's 8 now, and that'll be a little
when
weird.
When it's like, super track, yeah. I don't know many 8-year-olds who are diving into podcasts.
Like, if we talk about Disney, Mike, we might get there, but otherwise.
We'll save that for the last 5 minutes. Yeah.
Sounds good. So Moore's Law is both an empirical reality and a myth. And the empirical reality goes back to Gordon Moore in 1965. He's one of the founders of the semiconductor industry, noting that in the first 9 years of the industry, they have managed to double the number of components they can put on a silicon wafer while the costs fall at about the same rate. And he figures that that can continue for another 10 years. 10 years later, they notice, hey, you kind of did it. And some of his colleagues who are physicists look at it and say, we think this guy, well, probably every 2 years, then later goes to 1.5. We think we can continue this cadence well into the future. They figured that they would run out of space around 2010. And the industry achieves that. So that doubling of capacity is a way that tech, throughout the 20th century at least, is different than any other field, right? When you build a building, that building depreciates in value, but like quite slowly, because the next building you would build 5 years later is actually the same thing. I graduated from college in 2002, the computer that I brought to college in 1998 was a paperweight by 2002 because of Moore's Law. So that is an empirical reality for about 50 years. And it dies out around 2010, though people like to argue over that because there's 1,000 ways to measure it, and we always pick the measure that is helpful. But it's not a law of nature, right? The reason why it's lasting 50 years is that the people who run the semiconductor industry say, this is a coordination point. We're all going to hit these marks. We're going to build towards them. We're going to invest towards them. And a large growing industry then develops to render Moore's Law real. Moore's Law, again, at least it is at least cooling down at the consumer level for the past 15 years, right? The iPhone that you have now is not different than the iPhone that you had 4 years ago in any functional way.
It's crappier, but that's like, a whole other thing.
But, right. Yeah. But like at a minimum, like the processes are a little faster, but not in ways that you would notice in your experience.
Not for that extra hundreds of dollars that I had to spend for it.
Right. If you compare that to tech in the 1990s, like, again, this is one of the fun things in early Wireds is they have product reviews for like a camcorder that is $2,500. And you look at it and you think, if somebody waits 2 years, that's going to be like $600 and that's going to be a Christmas gift. Mm-hmm. So the things that were luxury consumer goods in year X are stocking stuffers, 4-8 years later. That consumer face of Moore's Law is unique for tech. And also has now disappeared a while ago. When I talk to my students about this, they give me a look because that is not the experience of tech that they've had in their lifetimes, right? The iPhone doesn't get cheaper and it doesn't get radically different and it used to. But that faith in Moore's Law, a joke that I've used in a few blog posts and will be in the book, is that Moore's Law at this point is a bit like Weekend at Bernie's, right? Like there's a decent argument that it effectively died off in 2010 and Silicon Valley has been carrying it around as though it was still alive. And that's because the myth of Moore's Law has always suggested that Silicon Valley is special. It is different because if the underlying technologies are radically changing every 2 years, you have a pretty good argument that regulators are not going to hold up to that. They can't move that pace. In 2012, I wrote an academic article called Social Science Research Methods in Internet Time. Mm. In 2012, I was a believer in Moore's Law and Internet Time. Like, the Internet of 2012 is fundamentally different than the Internet of 2002 or 1992. And I wrote in that piece, it's fair to assume that the Internet of 2022 will also be radically different than what I imagine now. Mm-hmm. And then it was when I was doing the 2018 piece that I started to realize, kind of had the aha moment of, the Internet of 2018, and indeed the Internet of 2022, is still basically the same five companies, right? That like that stabilization that has happened over the past, well, now 15 years or so, is something that we have looked past. And it's important, like Moore's Law suggests, let's pretend that that's not happening. Because if we disbelieve the myth of Moore's Law, then we find ourselves saying, oh, if tech is not actually moving as fast as it used to, then maybe we can have regulations that don't wreck it, but instead respond to these large companies and the incentives that they have for consumers and society.
So I'm going to wear a couple different hats now.
Please.
And have you take them down and okay. see how effectively you do it. So let's start with one of the more outlandish ones and kind of go full Santa, full Easter Bunny mm-hmm. narrative here, which is having myths like Moore's Law, if we accept your premise, and having myths like we are always on the verge of the next technology that's going to unleash this drastically improved future, helps progress society, helps us take gambles, helps mm-hmm. us invest in basic research and development, and helps us encourage a new wave of entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. So even if there isn't an empirical basis for it, just this notion carrying around that baggage of what used to be true perpetuates the sort of disruptor and innovator narrative that is a part or has become a part of the American narrative. Good, bad, otherwise?
I mean, I'd say provocative.
Okay. Santa is too.
Sure. So you're setting that up as what I would call a load-bearing myth. And I think it's fair to call that a load-bearing myth, to say this myth does encourage risk-taking, this encourages a style of entrepreneurship. This is something, you know, if what we believe is that a society full of startups just building stuff is the best possible society, then this is a myth that helps to perpetuate that. I would say, again, when the internet is radically changing every few years, it's very difficult to measure effects. It's very difficult to sort of assign any blame or say, is this good or bad for society? And I would say the pace of technological change has been slowing down for 15 years now. I know AI people are going to say, no, it's very, very new. I will point out that AI people have been telling me the next 6 months will change everything since 2022. I'm not saying there's not a lot going on there.
You still have an RA. You still write your own emails.
There's an awful lot of money going into that sector. I'd say that there's some real technology under AI, and also there's a lot of hype there. And the pace of change is not as fast as they keep it. Like Sam Altman every 6 months insists, this next 6 months is going to change everything. We can kind of keep time by it. So I would say the pace of change there is not so fast. And that does raise the question, again, like if it was 1998, the argument that, hey, all of this disruption, all of this, let's just trust people launching startups, that's kind of new enough then that I can put some faith in the innocence. Now, and this brings us to the little tech agenda directly, I think to apply that innocence to the little tech agenda, we have to notice, hey, we've been saying this for 25, 30 years. The results are a mixed bag. They are very, very good for the venture capital investors. They're less good actually for a lot of the people running the startups. There's a book by Catherine Bracey that came out a few months ago called World Eaters. Catherine Bracey comes out of tech. She speaks to a bunch of people who have launched startups. And what she notices is how bad the culture of tech actually is today for many, many startups that could produce valuable products that would actually have returns, like positive returns, but they are not 1,000x positive returns. And so VC won't invest in them, and VC ends up being the only game in town. And so we're starving good companies for startup capital because of this overwhelming mythology that You've got genius venture capitalists. They will find the make it or break it successes, and they get to set all the rules. That ends up, like, even if you like startups, that's bad for a lot of really good startups even. So what I would say is we've been doing this stuff for long enough that we can evaluate the results. And the results suggest this isn't working out for anybody, or at least it's not working out so great for anybody except for the investors.
And with that in mind, we're now switching to a different hat. We were fortunate enough to have Kate Tamarillo on here from Engine, who does direct outreach and advocacy on behalf of what I'm going to now refer to as the littlest tech, thinking of actual garage-based entrepreneurs or folks working out of a co-working space who don't have the interest of VCs yet or may never receive that sort of financial support. Are you in favor of investing in those sorts of littlest tech companies, and would you support in continued investment there and policy that's trying to uplift those smaller tech companies? Or
I don't know her, so I don't want to say yes, I love it, and then find out that there's a lot
we said some wild stuff on that episode.
Fair enough. I'll take a listen. I would generally say I like the idea of a wider diversity of funding opportunities for startups, for new companies. I'm a little old-fashioned. I like the idea of a company being able to go into a bank and say, here is my business plan for eventually making more money than we spend. And a bank saying, hey, that sounds great. Do you have some collateral? Great, let's do it.
Right, a 1.1 multiplier instead of,
Or like a 2x multiplier. Like, I think it would be great if there was a fair amount of money in the system for small scale good ideas, as opposed to ideas that will either provide 1,000x returns or burn out really early. And I think the system right now is far too biased in favor of those 1,000x returns to the detriment of both other companies and society as a whole.
And I think that's a really important point too, of saying, okay, if we support these folks that are just bringing about incremental, tiny improvements to specific issues, that might achieve the future we were promised, or will at least get us steps in the right direction, rather than, I wonder if this is a fair summary of at least part of your critique, the idea of in alignment between little tech, meaning companies with the ambition at the level of, let's say, a Theranos, just to pick a big, popular, well-known example. If everyone's chasing a 100 or 1,000 times return, that incentivizes the sort of risks and the sorts of shenanigans that maybe we saw from Elizabeth Holmes. Yeah. Is that more of your concern, that this perpetuation of, if you're going to be an innovator, that means you do have to fundamentally break things and throw out norms and even lie to get what you need? Is that part of what is informing your perspective?
That's part of it.
Okay.
One of the lines that I've used in my Substack and will be in the book is
that— You're giving away the whole book here.
I mean, I am.
I'm trying to help your sales.
I'm trying to build up some excitement for it. Your listeners have been waiting for like a long 10 months to finally get their hands on it.
Yes.
But one of the lines I use this in particular when I'm talking about the history of the future of AI is that the trajectory of any emerging technology bends towards money. Mm. And that's particularly important when we listen to the tech futurists who are inviting us to imagine all the wonderful things that a technology could do. And many of those things are possible, but the markets will develop in the direction of financial incentives, right? Like, we live under capitalism. This is not a surprise. This isn't even radical. This is an obvious thing that they're always leaving out of their stories. So if the future bends towards money, then that means what we ought to be paying attention to is, what are the financial incentives? What are the things that are rewarded, and what are the things that are penalized? Because we will get a lot of the things that are rewarded in a market economy, and very little of the thing, and less of the things that are penalized. So the broad project of, let's just let Silicon Valley police itself, let's have effectively no regulations, let's let the big tech companies buy the little tech. This is the thing that I always found funny about the little tech agenda as a piece of writing, is one of their complaints is, well, the Biden administration is making it harder for big tech to purchase little tech, which means that we don't get our exit opportunities. Like, how is it the little tech agenda if one of your biggest complaints is this is being a little too tough on big tech scooping up our companies? It's the little tech investor, like it's the venture capital investment agenda labeling itself as little tech. It's not actually about little tech. It's about the investors.
So if I now were to take on the persona of Colin from A16Z, who we're fortunate to have as a part of the series, he may point, for example, to the American Investor Network's explicit agenda. You can go on their website, look at what are their issues, what's their vision. And among those issues are things like workforce development, upskilling and reskilling workers, ideas about access to capital, as we've discussed, ideas about access to key components of the infrastructure needed to develop emerging technology, and things like providing startups with, or making markets more susceptible to new entry and facilitating exit, all of these good beneficial things. Do you have any issue with those planks of the actual agenda as interpreted by the American Innovators Network? Or do you, would you endorse those?
My guess is, if we ran down the exact list in like with it in front of me, my guess is that I would like 70% of those individually. There'd probably be 30% that I'd say, I think that's like, I'm a political communication professor. So when I read something like that, I mostly think, what is the framing and what do they mean? So my guess is that 30% of that I would flag as like, I think you're reframing something that phrased a different way I would disagree with. I imagine a lot of those bullet points are things that I personally would agree with, though. And then the question I would ask is the project of the Little Tech Agenda, which is an A16Z project, is the project of it actually moving forward all of those bullet points, or is it primarily focused on, let's make sure that A16Z's investment portfolio does really well for A16Z? Like, there's a Henry Ford element here of, you know, whatever is good for my company must be good for America. Like, that's kind of the vibe that I get from every time that I hear Andreessen speak on this stuff. And he's welcome to believe that himself, but I don't think the rest of us should go along with it.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if we take your critiques of the Little Tech Agenda itself, I wonder, to push you to an extreme potentially position, to say, all right, well, at least it's better than big tech, right? At least they're not explicitly saying, let's make Google stronger or let's make Meta stronger, the folks that already have just outsized power and concentration and influence. At least they're trying to incentivize some new companies. Yes, they may get swallowed later on, but at least we have competition in the short run. Is that not something we should be in favor of, all else equal?
I mean, that's a very heavy all else equal is the problem. Right. If we're encouraging, there's a really great piece from Gideon Lewis Krause from, I think, 2014. It's titled No Exit, It's in Wired. So I read it back when I was doing that read through.
Okay. You've got most of these pieces memorized.
I teach a class on it.
Fair enough.
I don't have the entire 25 years just sort of rattling around the memory banks, but the good ones.
AI might be able to help with that. We can get a Neuralink for you.
It could. Great. Yeah. Thanks. This interview's going great. I'm going to get implanted. Gideon Lewis Krause writes this piece in 2014 about the culture of startups at the time. And when I teach it alongside a piece from, I think it was 1999, about culture of startups back then and sort of noticing the differences as Silicon Valley itself grows and gains power. And what was standing out in 2014, so over a decade ago, is the extent to which competition amongst startups is basically just offloaded R&D for big tech. Like, instead of having your own research and development department where you have to pay like healthcare costs for your employees, you can fund startup. You can help fund the startup ecosystem. They all do that, and the stuff that works out, you just buy. So that ends up being a version of little tech competition that isn't opposed to big tech at all. It's actually like, that is what the ecosystem has been set up to support almost explicitly. It's been 11 years since then, and I don't operate in Silicon Valley personally, so I don't know how the culture has changed. I'm neither that type of scholar nor that type of reporter, but my sense is that that's gotten worse. And a world where we have a lot of competition amongst little tech, amongst startups, but it's really all set up for a network of very well-capitalized investors who are all in the same WhatsApp groups, then chatting about, okay, who's gonna acquire what so that we all make out well for this, and a few big tech companies still can retain power. That's not actually doing anything about big tech power. If you want to do something about big tech power, you need to enforce antitrust law, right? Like, you need to enforce regulations. You need to do all of the things that led Andreessen to get so mad at Lina Khan and at Joe Biden. So at the sentence level, I might buy it. As a broader project, though, I don't think that ends up serving the goals that we're claiming to serve.
Yeah. So if you're taking the shoes of a startup founder and you're thinking, I need to make some sort of return here, it sounds like you may be in favor of perhaps more creative policy that's saying we need to find new ways to reward this sort of risk taking on behalf of those folks in a garage or at a co-working space, rather than hoping to get acquired. Because for a lot of firms, or the narrative, and we heard, for example, from Kate at Engine, that some folks get into the game because they see the potential of being acquired. Right. And that is an incentive to, you know, create new products, test new technology. Would you support more creative ways of trying to make sure we still encourage some degree of innovation?
I'd certainly be open to it, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I like the idea of going back to like challenge grants. Like, again, this is because I spent so much time focused on the past 30 years.
Tell us more about those, just in case your daughter again decides to listen in a couple of years.
At least it's not the same Disney show on the TV, right?
Yeah.
So challenge grants is basically the government saying, or in a big tech could do it too, but ideally the government, or let's say the NSF, saying here is a major scientific benchmark. Whoever meets it, like we saw these a lot with things like the early years of self-driving cars. Here's a major benchmark. If you can meet it, you get $1 million.
Go drive this AV across the desert. And if your AV makes it, here's some money.
So that sort of thing. Or also just sort of big, I mean, nanotech in the late 90s and early 2000s had some real breakthroughs because the government basically said, here's a big pile of money to invest in nanotech. We think it's the future. A lot of that didn't work out. Some of it did, though. My favorite example of this is the Human Genome Project. Right, so the 1980s, the 1990s, they decided we are going to map the entire human genome, the book of life. And there was enough government money put into that that all the scientific labs said, we're used to fighting with each other, but actually we're going to get along because this is a worthy goal. And also there's enough money to support all of us. That ended up turning into a race with one private company that they declared a tie, but the private company, not so much. The guy who was in charge of the private company got booted out of it soon after it ended, so okay. not a great tie. But the thing that stands out to me is that the Human Genome Project was treated at the time as phenomenally expensive. It cost $3 billion in 90s dollars, which is like it's like $6 billion today. Mark Zuckerberg has spent about $60 billion trying to build the metaverse. That's 10 human genome projects. Like I like the idea again of taking a fair amount of the power away. And what I mean when I say power, what I really mean is right now all the money is again in these small investor networks, right? It's in A16Z and a few other orgs. It's in Y Combinator and all the alumni of Y Combinator. And they are small enough groups that they can coordinate again via WhatsApp. When they're the only game in town, we're only going to get innovation that matches their preferences and makes money for them. If instead we said either the really big companies, or I would prefer the government, like right now the NSF is losing funds. I would love it if we had NSF, NIH having large amounts of money that they then set up to spend towards audacious scientific goals. And I'm pretty sure you get Human Genome Project worked. And it was relative to what we see today, really cheap. We could have 10 human genome projects for the cost of the metaverse, which still isn't here and is still a punchline. That, again, I don't control Facebook. I don't control Meta's budgets. So I don't get to make that choice. But if we're talking about what would we like our science and tech policies to be, pretty big pot, or relatively big or relatively small compared to what Meta's spending. But multi-billion dollar pots of money towards large, audacious scientific goals are pretty effective at getting people in garages to say, okay, we got an idea for this, let's try it out.
Let's go for it.
And small scale funders saying, you've got an idea, I'm gonna help you out and then I'll get a piece of it. Like all of that can work quite fine for I think smaller dollars than we're seeing now.
And what I'm excited about in the short run and maybe the medium run is seeing how this overlap between the people who may embrace the little tech agenda for the policies they see mm-hmm. on paper, mm-hmm. and the folks who are now backing the abundance mm-hmm. agenda, both saying, how do we create the right incentives and regulatory environments to encourage innovation? Mm-hmm. Similar overlaps there, right?
Yeah.
Where if you go listen to any podcast and there's about 15,000 with Derek Thompson or Ezra Klein explaining yep. abundance, they'll say Operation Warp Speed,
yep.
great example of If you build it, we'll pay for it, right? And encouraging that sort of innovation, I think a lot of people for whom the Little Tech Agenda makes all the right ear sounds would say, I'm on board for whatever brings about the latest technology. So I think there's a there we could explain. Or please.
Yeah, so I've written a review of the Abundance Agenda, or the Abundance book on my Substack. I'm generally in favor of it with some notes. In particular, I think there's a at least two different versions of the Abundance Agenda. One of them is there's a scholar named Steve Tellez who wrote about this stuff before it was called Abundance. He was calling it state capacity liberalism. And that's basically like industrial policy is good. Having an administrative state that is large enough to be effective is good. The state should set audacious goals and then get out of its own way and do the work. I'm 100% in favor of that. And like, I come out of the environmental movement with one of my other hats and like, hey, that's kind of the green, like there's a version of that that is the Green New Deal. So I actually like, I quite like the idea of state capacity liberalism. There's another version of the Abundance Agenda that is essentially, there should be a lot of money put towards things and get government out of business's way. That's the version that I think the A16Z folks like a little more, is this idea of there should be big piles of money that we can get our hands on and nobody can tell us no. That I'm a little worried about because, again, I think an important part of abundance needs to be the government, when it sets a policy goal, should also get out of its own way. And that is, I think, distinct from government should set a policy goal and then just trust A16Z and Peter Thiel and a few other companies to figure it out on their own. And if they break rules, that's fine. I think there's a distinction there. And so, like, there's an intra-abundance debate to be had. And there are people in that debate who I deeply agree with and people who I'm like, I do not trust you.
Yes. I think on both fronts, there's, with respect to abundance and the Little Tech Agenda, as we're seeing right now, lots to figure out. And with that in mind, pushing you to think 5 years into the future, what can we expect from the Little Tech Agenda? Or what do you want to predict there?
I don't think we'll be using the term Little Tech Agenda in 5 years. Maybe a little too salty of me, but I doubt it. We'll find out in 5 years. I think that the Little Tech Agenda was basically just a branding exercise, that A16Z has an investment portfolio that was facing a lot of regulatory scrutiny under Biden, and they wanted a framework for saying the Biden regulatory agenda is bad. Don't regulate our companies. Let us do whatever we want to do. And that's not a very, that's not good framing. So instead, we're going to call it Little Tech. I think within 5 years, they will find, in the same way that we don't really talk about Web3 anymore, that was a branding exercise for blockchain companies, and it ran out of steam. I think Little Tech is going to run out of steam, honestly, within like a year or so. And then they're going to come up with another branding exercise. We'll have abundance as the sort of meta brand for at least a few years. Whether that lasts 5 years, well, I mean, we'll see. It depends on if there's movement building and what happens in future elections. But I think 5 years from now, in the same way that I, as a guy who reads a lot of like old Wireds, like invite me on to talk about the history of big data sometime. Mm. Like, do you remember when big data was the future?
Big data was cool.
Big data was the future and then it wasn't anymore. And then we came up with other brands. And now to talk about big data or to talk about the blog, when we talk about the blogosphere, that is both a set of websites, but also a time period. When I say when is the blogosphere, people have a set of years in mind for when the blogosphere felt like the future. Little Tech, I think, is going to remind people of, oh yeah, that was like 2024, 2025. But I think it's going to be a relatively short time period where that's the framing we were using. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to move on to other frames. There will be something else that feels like the future.
Well, Dave, I have to thank you for dissuading me from ever buying any bumper sticker with any sort of political message. With that, thank you, Dave, for joining us and really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.